Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
George Harriman's comic strip Crazy Cat, which ran from 1913 to 1944, is considered one of the greatest of the 20th century, inspiring a generation of cartoonists ranging from Charles Schulz to Bill Watterson, as well as poets and writers like E.E. Cummings and Jack Kerouac. Yet in 1971, a detail emerged about Harriman that would have ruined him if he were still alive and working. His birth certificate labeled him as colored, revealing that he'd spent his entire adult life passing as white. Michael Tisserand investigated Harriman's complicated family history and reveals how much he was able to inject his feelings about race and racism into his Crazy Cat strips, despite barely anyone noticing. His latest book, Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White, is published by Harper. I'm very pleased that it's brought him to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here talking about George Harriman.
He was from New Orleans. You are as well. Your last book was about Zydeco, something very different. But did you feel any special connection to him or to Crazy Cat before you began researching the book?
I always loved old comics. When I was a kid, I would spend hours at the 741.59 section of the library with the old Bill Blackbeard anthology of Smithsonian Comics and those other books were. So I loved comics, but it wasn't until it was about a year after Hurricane Katrina, I was up in Chicago, and I took my son, he's 6'3" now, but he was in my arms at the time, to a exhibit called Masters of American Comics at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And the second room was all Harriman originals. And at that time, I sort of felt an urgency to write about New Orleans history. And walking around and reading those Crazy Cat comics aloud to him made me feel very strongly that I wanted to explore this guy's story.
Well, Harriman was from New Orleans, as we said, but he grew up in Los Angeles. Do we see New Orleans reflected the New Orleans culture reflected in the strips in any way?
Not in any real overt way. There's his large extended family include Jelly Roll Morton, and there's actually a little Jelly Roll Morton reference in one comic about these waltzing mice that they're upset because their children were jazz mice and they were dancing and singing Jelly Roll Morton. But I think it's more in the strip in the way he deals with color and identity in a very layered way, the way that the racial society of New Orleans in the 19th century that he came from was a very multi-layered society.
Would people have spotted it, at least some really sophisticated people?
Well, Stanley Crouch said that he talked to Ralph Ellison, who was surprised to find out that George Harriman was black or was African-American.
And well, he's mixed race, but
mixed
very
race.
Light skin, passed enough to pass for white. He used to wear a hat so that you wouldn't see his hair.
Yeah, and you know, when we talked black, African-American, mixed race, we're really in Harriman territory because one of his great themes was that language just doesn't shoulder the burden of talking about identity the way we try to make it shoulder that burden. You know, he had this one comic strip where Crazy, and we're jumping ahead perhaps to Crazy
Cat
strip.
That's okay, we can go back.
I tend to think in Crazy Cat strips these days. There's this one strip where Crazy Cat's working in a diner, and Ignatz the mouse orders coffee and sends it back and says, "I wanted black coffee." And Crazy Cat says, "That is black coffee. You got to look under the milk."
Ooh.
And that's how Harriman approached this topic in this really sort of strange, transformative way that really challenges the whole idea of the way we try to, even now in 2016, talk about race.
Well, what about the challenge for you? Is it difficult to research 19th century genealogy in New Orleans? How far back could you trace Harriman's family line?
I now know Harriman's family better than my own. I was fortunate that I was able to move back to New Orleans to do this project. I thought I was going to be writing it from Chicago. And, you know, Harriman was a man of the world, and he went back and forth between New York and California. Never went back to New Orleans. But once I was in New Orleans, I was able to spend many afternoons in the City Hall notarial archives and look at the records of land purchase, and especially the Archdiocese, the Catholic Church archives. And that kind of told the tale. The baptisms and weddings of the Harriman family traced back ancestors. I was able to find Stephen Harriman, the White Riverboat pilot from New York, his great-grandfather, and the time that he was with Justine Olivier, a free woman of color, just long enough to have two kids, one of them Harriman's grandfather.
But slavery was still in effect at that time.
It was, and there was actually there was slave ownership within Harriman's family itself. It's a complicated, difficult subject in New Orleans, 19th century, and it's not it's as complicated and not easy as a Crazy Cat comic. And
complicating the story is that there's a whole bunch of George Harrimans here. His grandfather was named George. What did he do for a living?
His grandfather was a tailor, and his father was a tailor. There was a Harriman and Son tailor shop on Royal Street in the French Quarter.
Were they seen, thought of as African-Americans?
They were Creoles of color. They were seen as mulatto or colored or Creole. One thing that as I started to learn more about this family in 19th century New Orleans, even more than the complexity of their color in society in New Orleans at that time was the fierce political activity that they were engaged in. Both Harriman's father and grandfather signed onto a petition that a family friend hand-delivered to Abraham Lincoln for voting rights. They were part of a Creole seance movement when they would get together and be visited by Benjamin Franklin or Jesus Christ, who would encourage them during this really difficult time to keep going forward, that there will be, the light is ahead and they will enter a new society and create a new society. So when the Harriman family in 1890 decided to leave that world.
And 1890.
1890, yes. Yeah. I jumped ahead a little too quickly. In 1890, when the Harriman family decided to leave that world for Los Angeles and pass as white, I can't imagine, not just leaving the color behind, but leaving behind that rich, complicated, and very active society.
So that was their intention, going to Los Angeles, which was at that time a pretty much pioneer territory, that they could pass for white?
Yes.
And transform their identities there?
Yeah, and it's such a difficult thing to talk about in some ways. It's such an, hopefully antiquated and growing even more antiquated term, passing as white. In my life, there's sort of sexual preference passing that I knew. Growing up, I knew people who had to pass as straight. In my children's life, hopefully that will seem as antiquated to them. But at that time, they did make that decision to identify as white people in Los Angeles. And I think my sense of it is when schools started to close to their kids, that's when they made the decision. Because as soon as they got to Los Angeles, both George Harriman and his brother were enrolled in this wonderful school called St. Vincent's College. And it was a Vincentian school, which a Jesuit priest told me was as good as a Jesuit school, but without the publicity. So it was a very, very strict, very demanding classical education that Harriman enjoyed from that time on as a white student.
My guest is Michael Tisserand, who is the author of a number of books, The Kingdom of Zydeco, which won the ASCAP Deems Taylor Award for Music Writing. He also wrote a Hurricane Katrina memoir, Sugar Cane Academy, and now Crazy, which is the George Harriman story, Life in Black and White. How did he become interested in cartooning? And was Crazy Cat what he conceived of at the beginning, or was he doing other stuff first?
He was working as an office boy at the Los Angeles Herald when he was 16 years old, cleaning up the chalk dust from chalk plate, which was an old technology of cartooning at the time. You'd scratch into a plate and then pour the metal over it. And they started running political cartoons, the political convention as the office boy saw it, and he would start to do comics that ran in the classified section, these little, in fact, his first black cat was during that time, this little tiny black cat at somebody's side while he was reading the want ads. He ended up coming here to New York at age 19 and was living at a boarding house on Coney Island. And he was here right during the newspaper war between Joseph Pulitzer and William Hearst, a war waged with comics in many ways.
And he worked for both of them.
He worked for both of them. He went to Hearst first, got fired there, was told he just didn't have the spark and to give it up. went over to Pulitzer, did some comics there, and then coming back to Hearst and stayed with Hearst.
And that's when he developed Crazy Cat?
It wasn't until he was drawing little black cats. He was very, comics are kind of historically a marginalized art, and Harriman's kind of been marginalized in the history of comics, and Crazy Cat kind of grew literally out of the margins. He would start to draw these little cats and these little dogs, whether in sports comics or in comic strips, having little conversations. There was one boxing comic about the racial line in boxing, the color line in boxing between white boxers and black boxers.
That's because of the Jack Johnson, James J. Jeffries fight, which Jack London unfortunately coined the phrase the Great White Hope.
Exactly. And Harriman did comic after comic about that boxing color line. Sam Langford and Joe Gans and Jack Johnson, all these superior black boxers. And he started to draw boxers as black cats. And you first see that crazy cat face on the face of actually the Sam Langford boxing comics. And then he came to New York and was trying to find a strip, did a strip called The Dingbat Family. And it was right after that Johnson-Jeffries fight that he put a little white mouse with the black cat, and they started battling out with the white mouse, throwing a little pebble at first, and then it was a champagne glass, and sooner or later became a brick, and it stayed a brick.
And the cat winds up being the victim all the time. He gets hit in the head. It's almost slightly masochistic.
Well, it's absolutely
masochistic. Is that a comment on race in America at the time?
I tend not to see Harriman's work as a grand allegory. I more think that Harriman brought everything he had into the strip. And this relationship between the white mouse and the black cat was certainly part of that.
Now, the spirit is almost Dadaist. Was he sophisticated enough?
Absolutely.
Was he aware of what was going on in the world of art?
I met a woman, Hal Roach's niece, who knew Harriman and said he always carried a book with him at all times. He was part of a group called the Penguins that brought in a Vortices show in the late 19-teens here in New York. He was good friends with the person who developed the Armory show here. His friends Rudy Dirks, who did the Katzenjammer Kids, had paintings in the Armory show. Harriman was very well aware of what he was doing, and I think very conscious of those trends in art as well. And I think when he started doing comics, especially in the late teens, that were frustrating readers because they did go back and forth about language. He did one comic where Crazy Cat and Ignatz the mouse were debating whether or not language is so we can understand each other or language so that we can misunderstand each other. I think it was an intellectual question for Harriman, and I think also, given his situation as a person passing in society, it was one that struck really deeply for him also.
It's also gender bending.
He was,
we're not sure whether Crazy Cat is male or female.
Or both or neither. Mm-hmm. Harriman did a Crazy Cat strip in which Crazy Cat talked about going to register to vote. Women got the vote, and Crazy Cat went to go register to vote and was asked male or female and didn't want to offend anybody, so said both. And when I think about that, I often think about Harriman in 1900 when he had to fill out the census when he was in that boarding house on Coney Island and had to choose a race and must have had a sort of similar experience. Frank Capra, the director of It's a Wonderful Life, asked Harriman. Readers hated this fact that Crazy Cat was both male and female. It's very confusing to read. They complained. They asked the newspaper to drop the strip. And Capra asked about this. And Harriman said, who was a student of Shakespeare, said that he liked to make Crazy Cat a sprite, sort of like Ariel in The Tempest, I think, a sprite that was free to butt into anything. And any cartoon adaptations of Crazy Cat always fail once Crazy Cat opens the mouth and there's a sort of a little girl voice there. And in the book, I worked very hard. There are no pronouns referring to Crazy Cat.
Because male or female, male or she.
Male or female. So, yeah, Crazy Cat is a great gender-fluid cat.
Well, you mentioned that readers often ask for it to be dropped. By the time I saw Crazy Cat, it was a cult mm-hmm. favorite, considered one of the greatest strips in the history of the 20th century. Did some people react to it that way then, or was it always kind of marginal?
Absolutely. It seemed to have had this real following in Harvard. When E. Cummings went at Harvard, he papered his dorm wall with Crazy Cat comics. And Gilbert Seldes went on to champion Harriman in the pages of Esquire. They were in Vanity Fair. Edmund Wilson was a fan. And right after Harriman's death in 1944, E. Cummings wrote to his publisher and said, I want to put out an anthology of Crazy Cat comics. I don't want this guy to be lost to history. And when you read the early E. Cummings letters to Gilbert Seldes and to others about Crazy Cat, you see E. Cummings kind of taking on Crazy Cat's voice. Crazy Cat speaks in this really strange blending of Yiddish and French and German and newspaper slang and Elizabethan English. And you see E. Cummings, it's hard to quite see where that ended and E. Cummings' own poetic voice began. It just sort of seems to trail into that direction. And that was the book that led to a greater appreciation of Crazy Cat. Charles Schulz saw that book when he came home from the war and others.
Why did he retire? Why did Harriman retire?
He died drawing the strip.
Oh, it did?
Yeah, he grew more and more sick in the late 1930s and early 1940s. He suffered from migraines. He had arthritis. There were jokes, even when he was about 30 years old, he was making jokes about having rheumatism. And, you know, I don't want to say that he was depressed, you know, in a diagnostic fashion, but there are letters from friends and people talking about trying to get him to come out of his house. He was in a beautiful house at the end of a winding road in the Hollywood Hills at that time and continued to draw this really lovely, joyful strip, but was going through hard times. He had lost a lot of people in his life by then.
In her review in the Wall Street Journal, Sarah Boxer wrote that women are practically non-existent in this biography and that Harriman was, in fact, surrounded by unhappy women. And he spent his life trying to escape them. Is that fair criticism?
I don't understand where she gets that interpretation from, actually. There's very little information about Harriman and his wife available. Very, very little I could track down. No letters between them. The only moment I found Harriman writing was after his wife died in a tragic car accident. He was planning a surprise party for his daughter and sent a letter to his friends in Arizona and said, Kitty was his nickname for his wife, and said, this is Kitty's idea. She talks to me. And this was after his wife had died. So I felt the love and the loss and the grief at that moment. It is true that it was a man's world in the New York art departments at Hearst and Pulitzer. Nell Brinkley was probably the exception to that rule, this great woman cartoonist that really didn't have much interaction with George Harriman that I found. But later in his life, I'm not quite sure why Sarah actually wrote that, because there were some amazing pioneering women that were very close to Harriman. Louisa Wetherill, who translated the life of a Navajo medicine man and wrote about the Navajo and spoke their language and was quite an Arizona pioneering, very close friend to Harriman. And then in the last years of his life, there was a woman named Louise Cher Swinnerton, who was actually divorced from Jimmy Swinnerton, Harriman's best friend. I was a pioneering journalist very early in her life, and they shared a love of the desert, the Monument Valley, the place where Harriman set Crazy Cat. And I was able, happily, to find a lot of correspondence between them and talk with her grandson and was able to talk about that relationship in great detail.
Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White is published by Harper. My great thanks to Michael Tisserand for coming by to talk about it.
It's great to be here, and I love bringing people to Crazy Cat. After 10 years of research, I never get tired, and I'm still seeing new things in his strips.
In April 2016, computer technicians at the Democratic National Committee discovered that their computer servers had been hacked. In the days and weeks that followed, they learned that the cyber thieves had taken sensitive documents, emails, and donor information. And although President-elect Trump continues to question it, it's become clear that Russia's spy service was behind the hacks. In his latest book, The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election, Malcolm W. Nance follows the story through a labyrinth of cyber espionage while detailing Donald Trump's many personal associations with Vladimir Putin and the Russian oligarchy. Malcolm Nance is a New York Times bestselling author who served as a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer for the U.S. government's special operations, homeland security, and intelligence agencies. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Hasn't your specialty in the field of national security policy been in anti- and counterterrorism intelligence in the fight against ISIS and other jihadist groups? Is this a departure for you?
Well, it's not much of a departure, because anyone who knows the intelligence community over the last 30 years, I've been involved in almost 35 years, will know back in the 1980s, everyone, and I mean every officer, every collector, anyone who was involved in the military or the intelligence community was always briefed about the Russians. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that they brief you about is they brief you about counterintelligence, Russian spies coming to recruit you to be an agent for the Soviet Union at that time. So we're all steeped in the old school KGB tactics. And what's so interesting about why I wrote this book is because I saw those tactics pop up and become very apparent that someone, and a lot of people, led by the spy master in chief, Vladimir Putin, was using KGB operational techniques to carry out this operation.
The KGB doesn't exist anymore, but he was he worked for its successor.
Yes, as a matter of fact. Well, you know, people say that. I have a famous.
How different are they?
Oh, they're not different at all. As a matter of fact, the only thing that changed were the letters. And in 1991, they removed the border guards from the KGB and changed its name to the Office of State Security, the FSB. They actually had an interim agency in between there, the FSK. But none of the missions, none of the operations, none of the people changed. So today's FSB is the KGB, only with more interesting tools.
Now, in looking into this story, I'm assuming you have all sorts of insights that a journalist might not have had. You saw the story differently.
Oh, yes. And people say that, you're reporting. I'm not a journalist. I don't report. What I do is I'm an intelligence collector who has decades of experience. So I see things differently. And what's interesting about the timeline of my book, I first noted, and actually on NBC on July 25th, said once the hacks had come out at the morning of the DNC convention in Philadelphia, I said, this isn't a hack, which we had been watching since April. This is a large-scale cyber warfare operation against the United States perpetrated by Vladimir Putin. And because of my intelligence officer's ability to see this in a different light as a journalist, my book tracked directly with the CIA report that came out on September 23rd. On September 23rd, my book went to print. The CIA delivered their copy to the president.
So you didn't have to update it.
No, I didn't have to update it at all. It's still valid. And as a matter of fact, it came out 3 months ago.
Now, the hack, it was discovered in April 2016, just a few months ago. When did the actual hacking first occur?
They're not quite sure, but the first time that they believe that the entities infiltrated into the DNC servers was sometime in spring 2015. So almost a year they were inside the servers of the DNC, and it was looting, just mass wholesale taking of everything inside the servers.
So all sorts of information indiscriminately taken?
No. Every aspect of the DNC's internal communications, all emails, voicemails that were left by donors and constituents to the DNC, the voicemails of all of the DNC senior staff, they were systematically taken over a period of time.
How do we know what was taken?
Oh, well, that's just forensic analytics that are done by the cybersecurity companies that were contracted. CrowdStrike, the company that famously named these cyber entities, these malware packages, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, they were brought in to do the forensic analysis. And while they were there, the Russians were active and in the server stealing files in front of them. They caught them in the act. And essentially, what is Watergate 2.0? They broke into the DNC and wholesale looted it.
What happens when you catch them in the act? Can you send back a message saying, ha-ha, see you in the room?
Well, no, you don't want to
because
do that.
Because right now there's been a lot of talk about what some see as an inadequate response to all of this at the time?
Well, at this point, all you can do when you're actually catching them in the act is cut off their access to the servers, right? That you have to understand, the DNC is not an intelligence agency. It is not a government organization. They are a private entity, and they can only do what they're capable of doing using open, you know, open private organizations like CrowdStrike and things like that. The FBI does not protect them. The NSA does not protect
them. So this was really a matter of locking the barn doors after the horses have been stolen.
Oh, yeah. And the horses were continued to be stolen, according to Donna Brazile, right up to the day of the election.
What makes you and other experts so sure that the Russian government was behind the hacks as opposed to the Chinese government, for instance, or a number of freelancers?
Right. You know, hacks... You know, the way that they use hacks are sort of like weapon systems. I call them cyber weapon systems, and people in the cybersecurity community don't like that. But in the intelligence community, we see them as that. When they come in, it's not just them picking the door locks and getting into the computers. Often they have to go in offensively and leave, you know, behind these little cyber landmines that allow them to get further access, and then they loot wholesale. So the information that identified the Russians was definitive. The fingerprints led back to servers in Moscow associated with numerous Russian intelligence hacks in Germany, Estonia, Georgia, the Ukraine. They shut down 3 power plants in the Ukraine remotely from a Russian intelligence building in December 2015, same fingerprints.
And there were fears that something similar could happen here.
Sure.
But shouldn't I assume the United States has engaged in similar activities in regard to foreign governments? Weren't we hacking Angela Merkel, for example?
Well, that wasn't hacking. That was intercepting. And there's a big technical difference between that. Everyone, you know, has always steamed open the letters of diplomats and has conducted espionage. But what we're talking about here is something completely different. This is an order of magnitude different than that has happened in the past. This isn't like we took $20 million and bought a trade union in Venezuela and started handing out pamphlets on the street. This was literally Watergate, a second time only successfully done, and precision damage was inflicted by Russian intelligence against Hillary Clinton and the DNC.
And one of the big differences here that much of the material has been made public in an effort, many claim, to affect the election results. If you're stealing other people's information, you might just use it secretly to formulate your policies, but this is something quite different.
That's interesting because that's what the Chinese do. In 2008, John McCain and Barack Obama's campaigns were hacked by the Chinese. John McCain actually wrote a letter about Chinese policy in relation to Taiwan. It was taken from his computer, and the Chinese lodged a diplomatic protest before the letter was ever sent. So we knew that they had gone into the computer. The Chinese are more precise about it. The Russians hack and use and exploit what they've taken from a computer like we drink water. The United States uses cyber weapon systems and cyber capabilities like this the way a precision sniper would take one shot in 20 years.
My guess is Malcolm Nance, who has written The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Try to Steal the 2016 Election. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Did the hacks could go on continuously, or were they sporadic?
Well, the hacks went on continuously, according to Donna Brazile, because they not only got what was inside the DNC. Soon afterwards, by July, they were hacking the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And they used a very interesting technique, which they use for all the rest, spear phishing, which is when you click on a link from an email that may look like an authorized email, it floods your computer with malware, and then it links you back to a computer where they rob everything. The DCCC had donors' money taken, donors' logins, staff logins. The DSCC was infected. Then, when they couldn't get directly to Hillary Clinton's emails, they went to all her senior staff, like John Podesta and others, and got her emails that way.
And yet, she was criticized for not protecting her emails. She seems to be the only one they couldn't get to.
That server appears to be secure.
But according to an article in the New York Times, part of the problem was that somebody stupidly was taken in by one of those requests for a change of password, the kind of thing that you and I get those things all the time. It just simply delete. I understand that somebody is, and that was John Podesta's office, wasn't it?
Yes, and the technique is called typo squatting, and that's where what they do is they'll send you a link, and it will look exactly like the email that you would see from like Amazon or Gmail or something along that lines. And it'll say, oh, we found a security problem, change your password. But if you look carefully at the email, you know, it won't be Leonard Lopate, L-O-P-A-T-E. It'll be lopate.e.com. And you will click on that and it fakes a website and will bring you out and flood your computer with malware. And then, of course, they have watch your keystrokes, they'll watch your camera, and they'll steal everything inside.
So if that stupid decision hadn't been made by John Podesta or one of his staff, none of this would have happened?
Not at all. Not at all. Because, no, I mean, it would have happened.
Would have found other ways.
You would have found other ways. We're talking about the equivalent. The organization is called the Special Communications and Information Service, Russia's NSA. And the malware and equipment that they use is worth enormous amounts of money. They will find their way in.
What is kompromat?
Kompromat is a Russian word that means to compromise. Hmm. However, what it is, it's a form of political warfare that Vladimir Putin has mastered, using stolen information against his political enemies and rivals to get them out of the way. So, for example, there was one prosecutor that was carrying out a deep investigation of the Putin regime about corruption. And what they did was they stole everything in his computer, found, you know, videos and emails of a sexual liaison, and they just blackmailed him with it. And they compromised you. So we have had possibly the largest kompromat operation in the history of the world.
But it's also been pointed out that if we try to do something similar to Vladimir Putin, he has control over the Russian press,
sure,
and it really would not have the same kind of impact what happened here, where our press repeated everything that WikiLeaks spilled.
Precisely as Donald Trump instructed, right? The press would greatly reward the Russians. So, no, we don't have the effect, what we call the battle damage effect, against Putin. He wouldn't care one way or the other. He's an autocrat. He runs the nation as a dictatorship and no one will challenge him. He runs the media. However, the best way to get back to them is that he has a lot of oligarchs and mafioso that run the illicit cyber world in Russia. And if you want to get back at a nation like that, you don't go after the Kremlin to start a war. You go after the oligarchs and the cyber criminals and you take their money, which is all illegal.
But we've already been doing that, and we've applied all sorts of sanctions, and it doesn't seem to have had much impact.
Well, there's a difference between actually conducting a cyber warfare operation where you seize all of their illicit money from around the world and then tell them about it so that they have to go complain to Vladimir Putin. That's viable because none of that is legal, right?
And could that have been done with the Panama Papers?
It could have been, but no one actually cares about the content of the papers except the media. Going and taking the money that they may have generated, that would get their attention in terms of cyber warfare.
Malcolm Nance's book, The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election, published by Skyhorse. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Malcolm Nance. His book, The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. It is published by Skyhorse Publishing. And you refer to Donald Trump as an unwitting asset to Russia. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, early on, Mike Morrell, the former deputy director of the CIA and acting director of the CIA for a period of time, referred to Donald Trump as an unwitting agent of the Kremlin. Well, agent is an actual term of art. It means someone who is actually in the pay and or who has been professionally handled by a foreign intelligence service. And I don't believe Donald Trump is being handled knowingly by a foreign intelligence service.
There are no drops, no secret drops,
right,
in parks.
And there's no covert communications. So, but he can be an asset. An asset is somebody who works in your interest, who you can develop as an asset, who may not know that the strings are on his, are moving him around.
Well, to some degree, is that because he has been interested in owning real estate in Russia, and then there were there was the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow in 2013.
Right, and you know, this is probably the single most understudied bit of journalism that I have not found any references to. When did Donald Trump ideologically turn into a lover of the oligarchy and an admirer of Vladimir Putin? We don't have any references as to when he adopted the Kremlin's entire foreign policy regime of pushing back in Eastern Europe, disbanding NATO, destroying the European Union, all of the things he said in the campaign. What we did when I wrote the book was, like all the same report that the CIA wrote, was work backwards through his statements. And we can come to a point where in the campaign he said these things. But to adopt that ideology, you would have to have developed it over time.
Weren't people surprised when he brought the Miss Universe pageant to Moscow?
Sure, he was surprised, but he was brought in by a family called the Olagarovs, who were oligarchs, right? Really rich people, $100 billion. People that, you know, funds that Donald Trump could never imagine owning. And they brought him there because they saw him on Celebrity Apprentice. And they loved him as, you know, the authoritarian boss who said, "You're fired." They brought him there. They did Miss Universe. And while he was there, he was surrounded by the Russian oligarchy, most likely flooded with information about why Russia is the possible partner in American Christian axis against, you know, the Islamic world. And that's where his worldview appears to have changed to.
It's unclear as to whether he actually met Vladimir Putin. He claimed that they kind of met on 60 Minutes when, of course, the segments were shot in different places. Did they meet when he was in Moscow with the Miss Universe pageant?
You know, no one knows. And if he did, I think Donald Trump is just so absolutely desperate to be loved by people who have much more money than him. And he seems to have fostered this admiration of Vladimir Putin to the point where he lied, perhaps, about saying that he has connections to Putin. He does. The Olagarovs are one degree of separation from Putin, and they always have a KGB officer on their staff to make sure that their loyalty is assured.
But he also had another kind of connection through Paul Manafort, the national chairman of his presidential campaign and a close advisor, who had a good relationship with Viktor Yanukovych, the deposed leader of the Ukraine and a Putin loyalist.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. And that was reported upon extensively earlier this year.
Didn't seem to have much of an impact.
You know, but it didn't have any impact. He actually lives in Trump Tower right now to this day and still advises the Trump administration. But it was determined by the Ukrainian counter-corruption police that he was taking cash payments, large cash payments, one of which was designed to – now, this is a very interesting facet – was designed to cancel a NATO exercise in Crimea with the Ukrainian armed forces to create protest. And then that exercise was canceled, and a year later, Russia invades Crimea and takes it.
Beside the personal animosity between Vladimir Putin and Hillary Clinton, what do you see as the main reason Putin might prefer a Trump presidency?
Well, you know, the way I see it is that Vladimir Putin was a former human intelligence officer that ran spies into West Germany to steal computer technology, ironically. And I think he recognized something in Donald Trump very early on at Miss Universe, that this is an American that understood the street. He would do wrestling. He would do TV shows. He would understand the street. And he probably thought, if we get the oligarchs around him, we can bring him along to where he could be a beneficial asset speaking to the West about what Russia wants. Little did he know that he would run for president. And when he did, he threw the entire the entire Russian intelligence apparatus after him, got every bit of data that could help him, and then released it in a scheduled operation, which we're investigating today.
There are other terms here that I think most of our listeners are unaware of. Cyber bears, Guccifer 2.0.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what they are?
Sure. Yeah, and I'll try not to be very technical. The names that are out there, I collectively refer to all Russian hacking entities as the bears, right? It comes from CrowdStrike's name that they name these operations. Cyber bears are all the Russian cyber warfare organizations, which are comprised of Russian intelligence, right? Militias, of young men who just are Russian nationalists who will hack in favor of Russia. We call them militia bears. Then the
are they under the control of the government?
The direction of the government by using Russia TV and media to focus them towards targets. And we saw that in Estonia. They were blitzed, knocked down the entire nation's internet through militia bears. Then we have criminal bears. These are people who actually do hackings of credit cards, steal money from your bank account, will go out and lock up your computer for ransom using ransomware, and place false ads everywhere for adware fraud, right? Those people work for the Kremlin because the Kremlin controls all computer networks there. They are allowed to make money. And so,
and what does the Kremlin get out of that? Does it get a cut, or just simply the pleasure of knowing they're screwing things up?
I think to a certain extent they might get a cut. You know, that requires a lot more investigation than is available right now. But these are mafia gangs, and you have to know something. Putin came from the KGB, went to St. Petersburg, where he helped sell off the city of St. Petersburg. The reason he was so successful is he took all ex-KGB officers and controlled the mafia. And once he controlled the mafia, he sold everything. And then Boris Yeltsin saw he was so loyal and so good at this, he brought him to Moscow and made him the director of the FSB, Russian intelligence.
Now, in kind of denying all of this, Donald Trump has pointed out that the CIA has been wrong in the past. And in today's New York Times, there's a review of a book by the guy who interrogated Saddam Hussein, which kind of undermines the credibility of the CIA. The suggestion is the CIA will do whatever a president wants it to do, no matter who the president is. So if it's George Bush, the CIA will tell George Bush what he wants to hear. If it's Barack Obama, they'll tell Barack Obama what he wants to hear. Isn't that a problem in believing some of the things that the CIA is claiming?
You know, the only place that a president of the United States truly has real ability to put his finger on the CIA and make it work is right at the top of the CIA, and then at the deputy director's level. Everyone below that is a careerist, is a person who is there for love of country. In front of I know CIA officers, I have friends who have died, who are stars on the Wall of Honor at the CIA, who are the greatest patriots that you will ever meet. Can their analysis be faulty? Yes. But the analysis that went into this hack was so technically specific. It was the group that did it originally was not the CIA. It was U.S. Cyber Command and the National Security Agency. The fingerprints were seen globally in many, many other hacks. This was undeniable. And every one of the 17 intelligence agencies concurred with the evidence based on what they saw that this has been done. This is not Iraq WMDs and Dick Cheney telling people what he wants to feel. No one is going to do this for Barack Obama at the CIA.
Do we know who it was inside the Kremlin who reached out to WikiLeaks' Julian Assange regarding the dissemination of these hacked DNC materials?
No, but there you wouldn't know. This would be an operation that would be a covert in nature. I break out the structure that they would be required to have in place to do it. I call it an IWMC, Information Warfare Management Cell. We use this type of political warfare organization. It would require propagandists from Sputnik and RT, people from the foreign ministry, human intelligence officers from the SVR, Russian human intelligence, cyber warfare officers from their version of NSA, and then people to monitor the television 24/7, 365. Then a special liaison like Guccifer 2.0, who is a fake entity, to pass that information on to WikiLeaks. And knowing WikiLeaks would be their laundromat, this would make its way to the global news media and do what it did, damage Hillary Clinton.
And why do you think Julian Assange wanted to damage Hillary Clinton in particular? I would think that as somebody who just thinks that he is spreading the truth, all the hidden secrets, that he'd be just as willing to spread some of the secrets of Russia.
Interesting, but he doesn't. He released absolutely nothing about Republicans and absolutely nothing about Moscow. He, there's a good book that's come out by followers of Julian Assange that show that he had this ideological change where he became a very vengeful individual and is using WikiLeaks as a weapon system. He views Hillary Clinton as the person that got him locked into the Ecuadorian embassy right now in London and took it personally. And he made statements before the election that he personally was going to damage her. Russia saw that, used him. He willfully went along with it happily. And now WikiLeaks itself has been sullied.
And now we're hearing all sorts of stories, and it's hard to tell, considering all the fake news, what to believe. Fusion is reporting that Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump were set up by Wendy Deng Murdoch, the former wife of Rupert Murdoch, who, as Fusion is reporting, might be romantically linked to Vladimir Putin.
No, Vladimir Putin is a KGB officer, right? Old school, communist. Exactly like you see in the James Bond films. And he loves the organization. He refers to his new intelligence officers as the new nobility of Russia. He will do this operation himself. He doesn't need any cutouts. He has more than enough national capability. And Wendy Deng doesn't have to do anything with Ivanka Trump for him to get, obviously, to develop Donald Trump to the point where he loves Russia in some ways more than the United States and has proven more loyalty to them than he has certainly to our current government.
And a listener wonders whether Trump might have committed sedition for encouraging Russian hacks.
That remains to be seen. I understand that there are calls now for a select committee to investigate this. This requires very deep, not just congressional investigation, but counterintelligence investigation to determine perhaps it is people on his staff. One thing is certain, Vladimir Putin keeps FSB officers and ex-KGB officers in the pocket of every oligarch. You cannot do anything in Russia unless Putin operates through those intelligence officers and allows you to do it. So if Trump was brought along by oligarchs and bought into their worldview, he has bought into the worldview of the former Soviet Union's intelligence agency.
And haven't a lot of Americans as well?
Yes.
As we've just seen in recent polls, a growing number of Republicans who in the past would have just hated Russia, seen it as synonymous with the Soviet Union, are now full of admiration for the country and think Vladimir Putin might be a really great leader.
It's absolutely stupefying, just the buy-in that the people who love Donald Trump are willing to listen to anything he says and to adopt any ideology that he puts out. And there was a very good article that was written in The Guardian this morning talking about Russia's worldview, right, of how they view themselves as a vanguard of now modern Russian Orthodox Christianity against the West and against modern liberalism of all things.
The immorality of the West.
That's right. And he has brought Donald Trump into this ideology. Trump will never say a bad word against him or any of these things, which are a threat to the security of this nation.
Do we know to what extent hacking was done at the RNC?
You know, interesting, because very early on when we talked after Donald Trump made the plea for the Russians to hack, I made a statement on NBC where I said that is a clarion call to Russian intelligence, not to actually hack Hillary Clinton, but they will need to demonstrate that they hacked the RNC or attempted to hack it. It appears that a month later there was an attempt to hack the RNC. They do not have the cyber capability to resist an actual hack by Russian intelligence. They don't. The way that no one has the ability to resist our NSA if they want to get into your computer, when somebody spends a billion rubles to go around the world and steal things, they will steal things. I think it's just the Russians made a scan, as what they call it in the cyber community, where they just went and took a look. But the only people who were hacked were John McCain, Lindsey Graham, both whom are anti-Russian hawks and pro-Ukraine, and Colin Powell. And his emails came out the week before he was probably going to endorse Hillary Clinton, and it discredited him.
Malcolm Nance, whose previous book was a New York Times bestseller, Defeating ISIS, this one, The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Try to Steal the 2016 Election. It is published by Skyhorse Publishing. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I love the show.
Toys go in and out of fashion, but the gift of a good book can last forever. That's why the Leonard LoPate Show Book Club wants to hear from you about books you loved when you were younger and that you want to share with the young readers in your life. Plus, let's face it, if you're a parent who reads to your children, you probably want to share something that's not just entertaining for your son or daughter, but gives you pleasure as well. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at wmyc.org/LoPate, on Facebook, or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard LoPate. And to help us in this discussion, we have invited two people who know a thing or two about children's literature. John Shiska, a former national ambassador for young people's literature, founder of Guys Read, and author of books like Math Curse, and Jacqueline Woodson, a National Book Award for Young People's Literature recipient, Young People's Poet Laureate, and author of books like Brown Girl Dreaming. And I'm very pleased to welcome both of you back to our show.
Nice to be here again.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks, Leonard.
Over the summer, we asked listeners to call in with books that had changed their lives, and many of those submissions were books that they had read when they were children or young adults, especially To Kill a Mockingbird. Are we more likely to really love a book when we're young? A book, will those books have more of a lasting impact? What do you think, Jacqueline?
Well, I think To Kill a Mockingbird is absolutely timeless. And it's funny because I gave it to my daughter when she was about 13, and she really loved it. And I think we do have books that stay with us because so much of the young adult and children's literature really forms who we're becoming, so it resonates that way. And another one I'm thinking of course, is A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Well, you grew up in Brooklyn?
I did grow up in Brooklyn.
Maybe that's why it has special resonance for you.
Yeah, definitely.
John, did you grow up in Brooklyn?
No, Flint, Michigan.
Ah.
But I moved.
Please don't drink the water, John.
Yeah, no kidding. But Jackie and I have this great secret. I don't know if we should tell you, but
yeah, please do. It's all radio. Nobody's listening.
Oh, okay, perfect. As long as we got that out of the way. That's why we love kids as an audience. They are the most incredible readers. They just give you their whole selves. And I think that's why people really remember those books from childhood. It's just like, just forms them, like Jackie was saying. It makes them into who they become.
Some more than others. For example, Maria from Long Island wrote us about The Phantom Toll Booth, seems to be a perennial favorite. She says it captures the imagination, grows with the child as a reader, and gently delivers philosophical and life lessons without being preachy. When the two of you are writing, is that something you keep in mind?
Once you start getting didactic, your reader is gone, because kids read for the same reason we do. They read because they want to hear a good story and they want to become a part of that dream of fiction. They don't read to learn. I always say if I was going to try to teach children, I would write textbooks, but I write because I have all these questions. And when the kids come to the literature, they're asking questions too about themselves, and it expands them. And I think that's how I think it's more about the children growing from the experience they've had with the literature.
Yeah, and I think that's what every kids book author finds out pretty quickly. Like, if you're coming just to deliver a message, you get eaten alive by your audience also. I guess that's the other secret of our audience. They don't suffer fools gladly. Even if they're first graders, they'll at least show you by picking their nose and rolling around.
Oh, man. I know. And if they're seventh graders, they just heckle.
Oh, that's worse. I don't go with the older ones, yeah.
We have invited our listeners to join the conversation. The number is 212-433-9692, and a whole bunch of people have started calling in. So Jesse from Brooklyn, we've put you on the air. Hi, Jesse.
Yes, hi. Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I am calling because a book I got when I was like probably like 9 or 10 from my dad was called 13 Clocks by James Thurber.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting book about a man who wanted to kill time. So he had all these clocks in his house, and he would have a saying, "I'll switch you from your Google to your Zatch."
That's before Google became a word that we all would use.
Yes, a verb, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very interesting. It was a great book.
Was it written for kids or was it written for adults?
It was a book that my dad kind of got me as like a young kid to say, here, you could read this on your own now, as opposed to having you know, bedtime reading where he would read, like, rutabaga stories or something like that. But
that was definitely written for kids in the same way like a Phantom toll booth. It was just filled with wordplay and great subversive kind of stuff like that.
Let's take another call from Francine from Pelham Bay, Bronx. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you today?
We're well. I can't speak for my guests, but I'm okay.
Okay. The two books that I remember deeply from my childhood were The Hannah, about a Quaker girl in pre-Civil War Philadelphia. The author is DeAngelis, Marguerite DeAngelis. And the second one was what you folks have already mentioned, Tree Grows in Brooklyn, by Betty Smith. And they were important to me because they were about people, my own gender, but living lives in situations totally different from where I was living in a very comfortable upper middle class environment in New Jersey. And they've stayed with me ever since. I mean, I've bought copies and keep them around the house in my personal library.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for calling us.
And I think that's an interesting point about the books being very different from one's own life, right? And how, and that's one thing that kids also and adults come to is empathy from seeing those experiences outside their own.
They have to connect to some degree, but they don't want to just read books about their own lives. They already know that.
Exactly.
And we do want to encourage their imaginations. My guests are Jacqueline Woodson and John Shishka, and we are talking about the books that we read as kids that we would love other kids to, our children to read, although in some cases they probably don't like the book as much as we did. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. A listener wrote in to our show page, Rebecca from Keene Valley, New York, rereading Beverly Cleary's Ramona series with my daughter was a gift for both of us. She connected right away to the working class realistic fiction about Ramona's family and friends, and the books gave her a way to see people in her own world as unique characters and identify narratives within everyday life as potential stories. She's now a sociology major in college, and I think her love of people and their stories goes back to Ramona.
Oh, what a great story. I mean, that's exactly what Jackie and I love to do when we go in to schools and read to kids, too. That you always, you know, there's a kid out there who that's just going to change their life potentially. They might become a writer or, maybe a great sociologist.
Well, since you both write books for children, I want to ask you about what you choose to write about. John, your books are often humorous takes on elementary school curriculum, math curses about math concepts. Your Time Warp Trio books are about history. Are they informed by your time as a teacher?
Yeah, they definitely came out of, I taught for 10 years in New York City, kind of all ages from first grade to eighth grade. And it just kind of soaked in to me, it wasn't really my test audience, but I learned from being around those kids, like just the excitement of looking into those things. And that's the kind of kid I was. I loved history and science, and I just decided when I started writing, like, what a great opportunity to mess around with all these subjects and kind of introduce them to kids in a really fun way.
But when you were first getting your start, didn't publishers tell you that your material was too dark or too sophisticated?
Yeah, those are some of the more polite things they told us. I had other letters.
Did you think they were right, or did you prove them wrong?
Well, I kind of loved it, because I knew. I'd been around kids for, years and just knew they loved that stuff. I mean, I think publishers were horrified that some kid might read The Really Ugly Duckling growing up to be a really ugly duck in The Stinky Cheese Man and be scarred for life. I just said, it happens. I think it's good to know.
Jacqueline, I also want to ask you about sticking to your vision, because haven't some of your books contained content that some critics actually wanted censored? You and Judy Blume facing that kind of thing. How do you deal with it?
Oh, man. It's so funny because, you know, Judy Blume was one of the first people to let me know that I was censored because I didn't know. And she was putting together this anthology, The Places That I Never Meant to Be, of writers who'd been censored. And she called me up and wanted to include me. And I'm like, I haven't been censored. She's like, oh, yes, you have. And I think that's the case for a lot of writers. We don't always know when people are choosing not to have our books in their school libraries or in their public libraries or in their home libraries, or when people are speaking out against our work because they're not coming to us with it. But I think it's not going to stop me from telling the stories I'm going to tell.
And you've said that when you started writing, you wanted to talk about things that you felt were underreported in children's literature, but that were very familiar to your life, like communities and protagonists of color, girls and friendship. Did you feel that they were missing in the books that you were reading when you were young?
Well, people of color were definitely missing in the books that I was reading as a young person. Yeah. I mean, even when we're listening to people talk, they're not talking about books with people of color for the most part. And it wasn't until I came across books like Louise Merriweather's Daddy Was a Number Runner or Stevie by
Daddy
John
Was a Number Runner.
Yeah, or Stevie by John Steptoe, that those books are Betty Thomas, Down These Mean Streets, books where there were Black and Latino people in them. And so I really wanted to fill that void because I knew we existed and we had stories to tell, and they weren't out there.
Well, you were reading, the other alternative was to read stories about white kids, but do you think it's important for white children to read books that are about children of color?
If they don't ever plan to leave their all-white community, I guess they don't need to, but, you know, if they ever plan to meet someone of a different race, I always think, God forbid, let me not be the first person of color someone ever sees or meets. And literature allows you to meet people first in the narrative and then become familiar with that quote-unquote other, the same way for us as kids of color. We met a lot of white folks in our books, and they were very familiar to us when we went out into the world and actually met them.
You grew up in South Carolina and Brooklyn. Were you exposed to different kinds of literature in each place?
Yeah. In South Carolina, I don't remember a lot of the books I read. I mean, my sister was reading books like Hans Brinker and the Silver Skates and a lot of, Hans Christian Andersen, a lot of the Brothers Grimm. And then it was when I came to New York City, I grew up in Bushwick, that I really started finding books, even like Beverly Cleary and Judy Blume and S.E. Hinton, and then eventually James Baldwin, and early on Stevie and Langston Hughes and Nikki Giovanni and those people.
And what about you, John? What were the books that you were reading when you were a kid?
I read a bunch of, I read everything. We had all kinds of books around our house. Like, it was Dr. Seuss and Caps for Sale. And
yes,
the encyclopedias. I loved reading encyclopedias. I was just that, like, kind of information nut kid.
And you can't do that anymore.
No.
You got to when you Google,
a,
you only get one answer.
A missing piece. But it's like Jackie said, I don't think I ever saw one person of color in any book that I read. I mean, I think the closest I came would maybe be The Five Chinese Brothers.
Oh, man, remember
that. Which was just crazy. And I'm so proud of our business, the children's book business, for now. We just offer this incredible range of stories about all kinds of people. I mean, I give Brown Girl Dreaming, Jackie's book, to kids everywhere. Boys, too, who you think might not be the classic audience, and just say, hey, check this out. This is nothing like you. Or like Radiant Child by Javaka Steptoe.
Oh, that's
about
so beautiful.
Basquiat. It's just like, man, we get to just show kids the bigger world.
We were talking earlier about men reading Colette. So in the end, good storytelling is good storytelling, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Human beings are human beings. Judy from Richmond Hill, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Jonathan Livingston Seagull, because it's about being different. And when you're a kid and you're different, it can be overwhelming.
And you felt different when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was the only redhead. I had freckles. I had glasses. I read. I was the only one who read any books at all. I was smart. I could listen to a song and know the words to it every song I ever heard, I knew the words, and I did music, I played violin, you know, I was different.
So the Jonathan Livingston Seagull, She's Not Alone, that it was an incredibly popular book. I don't know if some of these books still sell well. Do you know?
I don't know about Jonathan Livingston Seagull. I was reading somewhere online where they were comparing books. You know, if you like this book, you'll love this book. And I'm trying to think of what the modern day Jonathan Livingston Seagull is. I feel like the whole body of children and young adult literature speaks to that. Even, you know, Jonathan Green's book, The Fault in Our Stars, like the books that there are ways of, that these stories are telling that are speaking more to the individuals that are coming to them. But I remember in 10th grade reading Jonathan Livingston Seagull and being moved by it. And then my sister being like, you're so corny. But I was moved by it.
Yeah. And other stuff like the Phantom Tollbooth, that still sells like crazy. Mm-hmm. Or Judy Blume stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's just, definitely.
It's kind of timeless.
Yeah, Mildred Taylor's Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry is another one that's
in fact, listeners have written in about that. Paula from Hudson, New York said that it's a beautifully written book for young adults about a young African-American girl in the South. My mother gave it to me when it came out, and it's always had a place on my bookshelf. But then you got to wonder what happens when you give it to your kid or your grand somebody you want to enjoy it as much as you do. And I hope that some people will call in and talk about that as well as we continue this conversation with Jacqueline Woodson and John Shishka. Our number here, 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we are back with our discussion about children's books, the ones we love, the ones we want to pass on to others, with John Shishka and Jacqueline Woodson, two writers whose books are favorites with so many kids and then parents and then their kids as well. We started talking, Jacqueline, a little bit about audiobooks. In the past, it was pretty much the adult reading to the child, whether it was parent to child or if you went to the library, sometimes librarian read to the kids. But is something lost when a kid hears the audiobook version?
I don't think so. I think it's a different experience, but it's still a literary one. I was starting to say that my daughter and I listened to the audiobook of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn together, and she couldn't understand the Brooklyn accents because the actor is phenomenal. She has these old, you know, the old school Brooklyn accent, and my daughter's like, what language are they speaking? But some of them, I don't know if you've had this experience, John, some of them are so well done. We just listened to Jason Reynolds' book, Ghost, as an audiobook, and my 8-year-old son, he has it on his iPod, and just had his earbuds in all the time, just walking around the house mesmerized by the story.
Oh, man, I love that book, too. I should go listen to it on audio.
It is phenomenal.
John, you had five brothers. Did you share books?
No, it was kind of a mad free-for-all. My older brother, Jim, and I, we were the two oldest, so we definitely collected Hardy Boys books, and we were very proud that we had a whole shelf full of books, and we kept them in numbered order, which is kind of such a weird, like, boy nerd thing to do, too, I think, which I love sort of tapping into. I have a program called Guys Read, where we just made the set of books, like, collectible, because we knew guys would want to get them all.
Now, Guys Reads, you also include books that have to do with girls?
Oh, absolutely. That's our kind of secret weapon. And, in fact, Jackie is one of the best contributors. She was in the volume All Short Stories. Each one of them is a different genre. And I asked Jackie when I was doing the sports volume if she had any feeling about sports one way or another. And turns out she's a track star. Or sort of was. She wrote this great story. And it's also this great way to introduce kids to, once again, that thing we were talking about, like experiences beyond their life. Like, I hoped kids would come to the book thinking, like, oh, I'm going to read that football story by that guy or that hockey story by the captain of the L.A. Kings, and then go, hey, maybe I'll try this story about running track by this person I don't know, Jackie Woodson. Mm-hmm.
And I had
find other readers.
I had a similar experience when I was a kid. I used to read books like Goodfield No Hit, baseball books.
Yeah.
And then when I was allowed into the adult section of the Brooklyn Public Library, I found a book that had a baseball player on the cover. It was called The Natural by Bernard Malamud.
Oh, nice.
And I took it out because it was a baseball book. And that's when I started discovering other kinds of writers, adult writers for myself. When I look back at that book, I don't know how I got through it with the age of 13 or 14 because it's really serious literature. But it also allowed me to start developing my own taste because my parents had read different kinds of books, good books, Faulkner, et cetera. But there I was discovering Bernard Malamud that led to Saul Bellow and a whole bunch of James Baldwin, et cetera, et cetera. I could develop my own reading list as a result. All just because of baseball books.
And that's a fantastic thing to realize, too, that as a reader, we pride ourselves on our taste and our selection. Mm-hmm. So when I talk to teachers and parents who are kind of stressed out about their kids not reading or what they are reading, I say, you got to let them choose, though. You got to let them work through that because, like, they're not going to be proud of some book that got assigned to them. They want to say, here's who I am as a reader. These are the books I like.
I never liked the books that I was assigned in school, and then I would read them over the summer and fall in love with them. But that's because I came to them on my own. Margarita from North Shore, hi, you're on the air.
Yes. So what you just said about stepping into your discovery of books, sort of towards adulthood, is a fun segue because I fell in love with Charlotte's Web by E.B. White when I was a kid. And he felt like my first independent discovery somehow. I don't remember if most other kids' books were recommended by teachers or parents. But then to grow up and realize that he also wrote for The New Yorker and wrote essays, and because I was born in Brooklyn and lived in Maine as a kid, I felt as though I had made a lifelong friend through that first discovery, which was really cool.
And now you're in Massachusetts.
And now I'm in Massachusetts. Still with a love of both New York and Maine.
Now, Charlotte's Web is another one of those books that seems to endure. Do you have any sense of why some books do just go on and others have their moment?
It's a really good question that I ask myself often. I think
that's also true with adult literature.
Yeah, but I think...
Well, Love Possessed, remember it was a giant... A monstrous bestseller. Does anybody read it anymore?
I haven't even read it the first time around.
Yeah.
But think of something like Knucklehead, which has been in my by John Jesko, which has been in our family's rotation for years and years and years. And it's just it's funny, it's thoughtful, and I think Charlotte's Web, the same thing. There is a way in which these books are timeless, right? Even though we know they take place in a period of time, there's this timelessness that they're not dated or placed in one situation that we can't relate to for years and years and generations.
The last caller was from Massachusetts. A listener from London named Linda wrote to us to recommend Ellie's Adventures, the Ellie's Adventure Picture Story books, which teach children about the importance of taking care of the environment. Can books like that have a lasting impact on a person?
Books
teach? I think that's in that same way, like we were talking about, books that kids are interested in. The strangest books kids can latch onto, too, and that can just become... I don't know, kind of their mission statement. And I'm sure she was probably a kid who that just struck her, that moment when she read that book, to say, like, yeah, I can do something. Here's someone who's thinking the same thing I am.
Last week, the Washington Post published a list of books curated by a Maryland children's librarian designed to bring, quote, hope and strength in stressful times, as well as to inspire activism. A lot of adults are looking to the literary world for similar inspiration right now, but can you talk about the role of children's literature in these politically chaotic times?
Well, I think adults should be reading it. Maryland librarian's list is not just for young people, it's for adults too. And I think given how stressed out we are, being able to pick up a picture book and gain some hope in 32 pages is a good thing. And also, they tend to resonate. So I think we do need to slow down and escape in the literature that's being offered to us and acknowledge that the stuff that children are reading and children themselves are important to all of our futures.
Let's take another call. Joan from North, what is it, Hailton, New Jersey?
Hello?
Yes, hello. Go ahead, Joan.
Oh, okay. My favorite book, and still is, when I was young, To Kill a Mockingbird. I know that probably sounds a lot different than the ones that people have been mentioning, but...
No, we actually started off by...
Yeah. Was an attorney, and my father was Atticus Finch. He many times was paid in things. He worked with people that didn't have much. You know, he didn't do any big lawsuits and money collecting things. That wasn't what he wanted to do. He was a pretty religious guy and very, you know, concerned about people. And, you know, even now when I either watch the movie or reread the book, it's like reading about him. You know, he believed in fairness and equality, you know, all the good things.
And we actually mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird is a favorite of adults. It's a favorite of kids as well. She really hit a nerve there, didn't she?
Yeah, heartily.
What resonates, too, with people is in children's books, we get that. I guess it's kind of a luxury. You can kind of be unafraid to deal with the really tough topics. I mean, I have second graders who ask me things like, why are we here? Which is kind of the ultimate question. And I love that about them. And so something like To Kill a Mockingbird really, like, gets into it.
Jen from Huntington, Long Island, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to ask Ms. Woodson her opinion about, I'm a school librarian, and I really try to have, you know, diversity present throughout the year and not just save it for 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that my
month.
Book...
It's the shortest month, too.
It is. It is. And there's a week-long, yes, there's a week-long holiday event where the kids are off. But when I teach book club, I run a book club after school. I have second and third graders. There seems to be a lack of diversity in chapter books for this age group. There's a lot of picture books, and then the older grades, fifth grade and up. But I didn't know if I was missing something as a brand new librarian, or if you saw this as well.
No, I don't think you're missing something. I think that is a place where there is a gap in our literature. And, I mean, you know, John's books, The Time Warp Trio, I think there's a person of color in there now, right, John?
Yeah, like and, all the time and everywhere we go.
And the stories Julian tells and more stories Julian tells, the Diamond Danielle series by Nikki Grimes. There are a couple that are out there, but it is a place where they're... Where you can look at picture books and you can look at middle grade, but in that space in between, there's work to do. You're absolutely right. And of course, you could go to sites like WeNeedDiverseBooks.org. You can go to the Coretta Scott King site. Well, you know this as a librarian, and you can find some books to fill those gaps. Put a Bell Prey, and so there are a couple of places. And I think also books on tape, coming back to audiobooks for that age group, they can read up a little bit. There are enough books that don't go too deeply into waters that parents might not want young people to go into right now, but where the language is so that they can have access to it, even if they're struggling readers or reluctant readers.
Moira on Twitter says her second son wasn't into reading when he was younger, but loved Tintin. She says it was a good segue into reading. Sometimes it just takes the right book for the kid to connect to.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Lynn on Twitter writes, I try to make Nancy Drew a thing for my friends' girls, but it didn't take. And she wonders if that ever happened to either of you.
I'm not trying to push Nancy Drew on anybody. I'm sorry. I've never had that problem with Nancy Drew. I've definitely gotten into the 21st century with reading. And sometimes, I don't know if you have this, John, but you go back and read a book and it doesn't hold up that way, one of your favorite children's books. But I wouldn't expect Nancy Drew to hold up. No offense.
On the other hand,
I even think like some of that's the wrong approach with a book. It's almost like talking about it like it's some kind of, I don't know, psoriasis treatment or something. Like, it didn't work. But you really have to like find out who that reader is. And Jackie and I both have sons who at one point in their life were, I guess we could call them less than enthusiastic readers.
That's because their parents were writers.
And it's crazy for us. We like, you know, almost want to strangle them and say, come on, this is our business. This is what's feeding you.
It's so true.
Jeffrey from Manhattan called in to say that he loved The Wind in the Willows and that it taught him how to be an adult as well. And happens with a number of these books.
Yeah, I forgot about Wind in the Willows. Those are great old crazy British books.
So what did we finally establish here? That if you can get a kid reading, you engage the kid in the world and get them thinking about not only what's going on in their own lives, but what's going on in other people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a win-win situation.
It does. And I have to tell you, my trick with my kids is I leave books in their bathroom. Accidentally,
nice.
Quote unquote, as opposed to saying you should read this book. I leave it in their bathroom and they're trapped in there for a while. And sure enough, they come out reading the book.
No, and that's a great low-key approach, too. I think that's our mission, like, is just to, like, give it a try. Mm-hmm. I kind of hope that with the short stories, like, kids read them and go, like, I didn't like that one. I go, try the next one. Mm-hmm. Or don't. Try another one.
Yeah, the book is out there, and I love that you're asking people to talk about their favorite books, because I think once we begin having this conversation, more books come up for Anne. Hopefully they're sharing those with the young people in their lives.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, because there are so many more books out there. People are calling in with wonderful books. My great thanks to all of you who called in, and to Jacqueline Woodson, author of Brown Girl Dreaming, Miracles Boys, and more, and John Shishka, author of The Stinky Cheese Man and Other Fairly Stupid Tales, Math Course, Curse, and more. It's been a lot of fun talking about these books.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Leonard.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.